So my guest is Dr. Philip Tallon, and Philip is the author of both The Poetics of Evil and The Absolute Basics of the Christian Faith. He's also the chair of apologetics at Houston Baptist. So it's good to have you on, and welcome to the podcast. Cultural apologetics at HBU, and that you teach a lot of different apologetics, but specifically you do a lot of the classes in cultural apologetics at HBU, and so I know you teach some classes where you explore art, film, literature. I was in one of those classes over the summer, so that was kind of neat. It's kind of a different side of apologetics that we hear a lot of the philosophical apologetics, but cultural is a little different. So we're going to talk a little bit about a unique aspect of cultural apologetics in film today. So we're talking about something that maybe most Christians would at least pause to talk about, and maybe even they write it off or think it's taboo, and that is horror films. So I guess we'll jump right in. Why should Christians watch horror films, or at least not write them off?
That's a question that I get a lot. And I think I like the way that you've kind of qualified that. So, should seems like a bit of a command. There's some obligation to do so. Typically with obligatory actions, they're right to do and wrong not to do. I don't think people are wrong not to watch horror films, and heartily encourage people to follow their conscience, as well as, a lot of people just have, they talk about being afraid of, taking a shower after watching Psycho, or, afraid of going in the ocean after watching Jaws. One doesn't want to scare people off of doing wholesome and good things. There's no command there to watch horror films. But if somebody does have the temperament for them, then I think that there's a lot of value to be gained. And so I would want to argue against somebody who says that Christians shouldn't watch horror films, right? I think this is an optional thing, which is to say that it can be right to do and not wrong not to do. And so you can just, you can watch these movies as your conscience and temperament dictates. Now, the value, to some degree, of watching horror films is the same value as you might get, engaging in any other form of culture, right? You kind of learn more about what's going on, sort of art that people are consuming. You become culturally literate, and something that's important to many people. And so those of us who are interested in pop culture, so I teach a course on film, visual arts, and apologetics, a lot of it's about pop culture, right? Because it's a powerfully shaping force in our world. I think almost all of us are, kind of enmeshed in it. So we want to understand what's going on there. And so that's a value. And I think that, and horror films are part of that and seem to be increasingly becoming a part of the film landscape critically. So you've got horror films, recognized at the Oscars recently. So Jordan Peele's film Get Out, was nominated, I think, for best screenplay, deservedly so. A lot of indie horror now is kind of attracting the attention of mainstream film critics, where, as opposed to when I grew up, and perhaps when you grew up, you're a lot younger than I am, Clark, but when I grew up, people viewed horror to some degree just as the kind of garbage that some people seem to enjoy, but which had really no value, perhaps except for a few of these kind of culturally accepted horror films, movies like The Shining or Rosemary's Baby or something like that. Now we're in a place where horror films are getting a lot of attention, and so Ari Aster is a new horror filmmaker. His recent release, Midsommar, had a lot of the cultural conversation around it. People are interested in talking about it. It's, in a sense, as big a release as any other Hollywood movie. It's getting as much critical attention. It's not getting quite the same box office as Infinity War was, but it, you know, people are engaged with it. And so if you see, you know, being engaged with, understanding, exegeting culture as part of your calling, you know, part of the thing that you should do, then I think horror is at least worth attention. But more than that, I think there are some specific things that horror does that are actually quite unique in the pop culture landscape and can really be quite illuminating if we are willing to wade through, as it were, the darkness of the films, you know, themselves. And so I think there's a lot to see there in this darkness that horror films conjure. And so for those who don't just want to kind of know what's going on, but who actually want to really, you know, kind of think about works of art, I think horror films are really rich texts very often to consider.
Hmm. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. You mentioned that, you know, some of the audience for horror may be not the most popular level audience. You know, the box office movies are, you know, your superhero films, your action films, your comedy films. Horror seems to be a more specific genre of people. And you were writing an article recently along with Cameron McAllister for the Unexpected Journal, which is a really, really neat journal that a few of our students at HBU put together. But you said this about some of those films that are a little more popular. You talked specifically about like the film Ted 2, Deadpool. You mentioned James Bond. And these are films that, you know, are a little more acceptable in genre. So you say they belong to more socially acceptable genres like comedy, action, reality TV, and their antics get a free pass, whereas anything in the horror category is often regarded as guilty by association. Yet many horror films consistently do the one thing that our other popular entertainers refuse to do, namely take evil seriously. They frequently move beyond trivialization to the much-needed moral wrestling match. So maybe you could expound on that a little bit. I think that was a really good quote, but talk a little bit about the way that horror movies actually address evil as opposed to more popular level genres.
Yeah, well, you know, part of the point we're making there, obviously, is that, you know, horror seems to have this special pride of place or shame of place in our pop culture landscape as being the one genre where people will say, oh, you know, I don't watch that kind of thing. You know, that's just, you shouldn't watch that. It's a whole genre, whole section of the video store when I was growing up. That's the bad section. Or, you know, maybe a whole category on Netflix now. You know, just these things are kind of out of bounds. And part of the point we're making there is that in that article you know, there are a lot of other genres of movie making that, you know, they get a bit more of a pass. People just kind of accept them without much consideration. But, you know, that doesn't mean that they're really more, any more kind of ethically commendable. So, you know, Ted, you know, made by Seth MacFarlane or, you know, kind of other trivial comedies sometimes just sort of float by. People don't take them too seriously. And so they don't wrestle really with some of the issues that are bringing up or even some of the problems they're in. But one really unique thing about horror is that it's, you know, trying, as it were, to kind of get into our faces and be confrontational. It actually, whereas, I don't know, you can watch some true crime TV show on any night of the week, and all these awful things are happening, but, you know, it doesn't really, not really disturbing in some way. You're just kind of, it's presented as entertainment. Or you watch an action movie, many people die in front of you as the, you know, the hero bravely guns them down, taking out the bad guys. I watch these kind of movies and TV shows. I'm not saying that people shouldn't, but they go down so easily we may not really kind of think about their content. And horror is sort of the exception that it disturbs us, it confronts us, it's sort of rude in a sense as a work of art. And there's a real value in that, and that it's going to kind of unsettle us and, like, you know, kind of press into our faces something that we perhaps ought to think about. And specifically, the thing that horror pushes into our faces is evil, right? And by evil, I have a very sort of Augustinian definition, which is to say that the evil is a kind of a lack of some good that should be there. So it's a disruption of the moral order, or the natural order, or the social order, or something like that. There should be this kind of thing that we all know roughly should be there, but it's like, it's not there. It's twisted in this really strange way. And so it's going to kind of upset us in a way that perhaps can just affect our emotions. That's why a lot of people don't like it. It also then prove to be a really kind of rich object for reflection. Why is this so disturbing to us? Like, what is it about this film that's upsetting? What's the good, as it were, that's lacking? You know, again, going back to this Augustinian idea, what's the good that's lacking, you know, that should be there, right? You can kind of reflect in this way. And then there's an additional kind of effect, perhaps, which is that horror movies, because they're intentionally violating by nature, they're trying to kind of violate our sense of security and safety and so forth. They also are often to kind of explore questions in a way that entertainment that's really trying to please a really wide audience, you know, tends to brush over. So horror movies are often the most explicitly religious of any genre. They're actually dealing with, you know, kind of religious imagery, religious possibilities, religious figures. But they're often confronting, you know, big cultural issues. And they don't have to, because their goal is to upset us to some degree, to make us afraid, they don't have to resolve some of these tensions in the way that, you know, a lot of other popular entertainment does. And so perhaps we all have a friend in our lives who is the kind of friend you're a little bit worried when your other friends are around, what, you know, he or she is going to say, because they just sort of like say whatever. And there's a real value, though, in kind of people like that, which is that they're just willing to sort of say the uncomfortable thing, even at the expense of, you know, kind of our social ease. And horror is a bit like that friend sometimes. You know, maybe you don't want to, you know, you don't want to give the toast at your wedding, but you do want to kind of hear what he has to say, because he's going to kind of tell you the truth, even if you don't want to hear it. And so there's a sense in which, not all horror movies are like this, there's a sense in which some horror movies, I think, can really provide that benefit for us.
Right. Yeah. And I think one of those uncomfortable realities, and it's in the title of the article you wrote with Cameron, is eternal consequences. And we don't stop to talk about eternal consequences. And the one place where we should talk about that the most is, you know, in the church. And we sometimes just kind of push that to the side and don't always talk about the eternal consequences. And horror addresses that, you know, pretty right on. In fact, one of the movies that has always stuck with me is the Exorcist film, which I personally would tell people don't watch it, but I can't really say that, because whenever I was real young, I watched The Exorcist. It was one of my first horror movies, and I saw it because I was interested in a girl at the time, and so I went and watched The Exorcist with her, and I was, you know, just a preteen boy that just, you know, hadn't seen anything in his life. And I saw The Exorcist, and it scarred me. And then I had to go home, and, you know, my parents didn't allow me to watch, you know, those, especially R-rated films as a whole, but The Exorcist would have been a no-no. So then I had to go home and debate, do I tell my parents I saw The Exorcist, and, you know, maybe they can comfort me or allow me to make a, you know, place in their room for the night, or do I face the demons that might be in my closet? And honestly, I thought I'm going to stick with the demons and face the demons rather than tell my parents.
Yeah. How do I ask if I can sleep, you know, on a little cot in front of their bed without revealing that I just saw this movie I wasn't supposed to?
That's right. Well, interestingly enough, you know, that was a novel by William Blatty, and he did an interview with Terry Mattingly. And he said this, he said, I knew what I wanted to do, the writer of the Exorcist novel. I wanted to make a statement that the grave is not the end, that there is more to life than death, And he added, my logic was simple. If demons are real, why not angels? If angels are real, why not souls? And if souls are real, what about your own soul? So I thought that was an interesting take on the Exorcist film, because here we are being presented with an uncomfortable truth. It's that friend that we don't want to, you know, we don't want him to say the truth, but it's there, you know, it's right there in your face. That you watch that movie and you go, wow, evil exists. This is evil. How can horror movies use evil to actually defend God's existence, or at least maybe present a case for life beyond the grave?
That's a great point. And I know that for some people, actually, for Cameron McAllister, my co-writer, his father speaks about The Exorcist as having largely this effect on him, which is to say that he realized that, you know, this movie was presenting him with possibilities that perhaps he believed in, but hadn't really taken seriously. And so if he's genuinely frightened by the possibility of, you know, demonic possession, then this conjures a whole world of, you know, of possibilities. And I think Stephen King, at one point in his book on horror, Danse Macabre, he says something like, well, you know, people say they're not afraid of, you know, ghosts or spirits or whatever. And, you know, but I just challenge them, like, go watch a scary movie and go find that abandoned house in town whenever, you know, everybody stays away from, you know, go kind of break in the rotted back door, go up in the attic and sit there from midnight to 3 and tell me if you're not genuinely afraid of, you know, something evil coming after you. The idea there being that in some sense horror reawakens our imaginations to the possibility of, you know, unseen forces, you know, things beyond kind of our, you know, just experience of day-to-day life, things that, you know, we deny are true when the lights are on and, you know, we're out in public, but, you know, perhaps in our hearts fear are possible. And so it can affect our heart in that way, right? So I'm sure horror movies have led many people to pray more than they had otherwise, you know. Perhaps after you saw The Exorcist, you know, you went back in your room and you genuinely prayed, like, God, just please protect me from any of this stuff. I think that there is that imaginative benefit, as it were, which is to say that, you know, horror movies can kind of open the door again, open the dark closet door at midnight again, to a sort of a possibility that, you know, has become very culturally remote. We don't take the devil as seriously as did our ancestors, but there's a potentially a real value there. And then, of course, if you're open to that possibility, then you can kind of follow Blatty's line of thinking. And Blatty was quite eager to actually, you know, use a novel to kind of reinvest a real sense of fear and possibility of demonic possession. He believed this is real. But there's a recent movie fairly recent movie that plays with this idea. So The Exorcism of Emily Rose, I don't know if you've seen it. It's a film directed by a Christian filmmaker, Scott Derrickson, who's gone on to direct Doctor Strange and other things. He's an excellent filmmaker. But he kind of plays with the idea of, you know, well, you know, if horror really scares you, the possibility of demons really scare you, you know, how certain can you be of your unbelief in the spiritual realm? And so in that movie, the whole thing centers around a legal trial between a, you know, where there's a priest on trial who basically was in charge of an exorcism. Of course, the exorcism immediately thereafter, the patient, as it were, died. And so he's then on trial basically for medical malpractice. You know, if somebody's dealing with a serious ailment, is a priest the right one to call? Like, basically, is exorcism ever, as it were, the appropriate medicine for someone's diagnosis? And there's a fundamentally religious question, a theological question, like, are demons real? Like, is this something that we actually need to worry about? And so he's on trial. There are, you know, two kind of lawyers battling back and forth, one of whom is a skeptic, but who, through the course of the film, then, you know, encounters these strange things at 3 a.m., you know, clock begins to misbehave and demons are sort of lurking around. We see this in the movie. You know, this is a a real possibility. And throughout this whole trial, she becomes less certain of her naturalism, becomes more open to the possibility of supernatural. The very last scene in the movie, she goes home, you know, see her clock by the side of the bed, the clock that's, you know, whose misbehavior is the sign of demonic possession. She turns it around to the, you know, the wall, turns the other way. She has become sufficiently uncertain, as it were, of her her naturalism that, you know, she's now a little afraid of this possibility. Back to that King quote I shared earlier. Okay, so maybe she's not so certain. But then there's an additional effect, right? Which is that, like, well, now if when I go home after watching the movie, I lay down in bed and I look at my clock, now I'm suddenly in the same place, right? If this movie is affecting me, as it were, by presenting me with the possibility of there being unseen things that are surround us, right? Unseen realities that can affect us and harm us. You know, if I take this seriously, you know, then there may be even good reason to be at least partly afraid, you know, of such possibilities. And so I think horror certainly doesn't always have this effect, but it can, as it were, reawaken our imagination to certain truths that we've kind of forgotten or shoved into the bottom drawer and, you know, left aside.
Yeah, that's interesting, because, you know, today naturalism or materialism is pretty popular, and so it makes you wonder, those that claim to be just specifically a materialist, meaning that no spiritual things at all exist or no supernatural forces are at work. I love that Stephen King quote, because I've thought about that myself. I don't know how you would, you know, lock that person in an abandoned hospital overnight and see how comfortable they are. You know, it's just it's kind of a hard thing to horror movies bring us to that place where we have to confront the supernatural, especially these, you know, specific type of films. Which leads me to another question.
Before you go on to that, there's one other thing I forgot about. I taught this class on film, visual arts, and apologetics. You were in it, and in the course of talking about horror, I should mention that one of your fellow students, perhaps you remember this, began using horror in a sense as a conversation opener for people. So do you remember her posting about this? So she began asking people, what do you like? Do you like movies? You like horror movies? So then she used this as an entree about, like, well, if you like horror movies, do you think that there's really such a thing as true evil, right? Do you think that such a thing as true evil exists, like objective evil, we might say? Not that evil is a substance. Christian theology has typically denied that. But just that, like, that there are things that we can say, yes, that's evil, right? That's She's been using this as a conversation starter, you know, with various people, as a kind of an unusual way into talking about, well, okay, so if you think that there are sort of things that are objectively wrong, you think things that are objectively right, and kind of having this discussion about morality, you know, where do we get this intuition that certain things are wrong or right from? And so it's wound up being a really successful way for her to open up, you know, spiritual conversations. Even the point that she said, she's having this conversation with her Uber driver, and they're just kind of going back and forth, and the Uber driver realized, you know, oh my goodness, like I haven't been taking, you know, my faith seriously. I need to, you know, think more seriously about these things. So she followed, as it were, that William Peter Blatty line of, well, if I think demons are real, then, you know, I think gotta think something kind of good, spiritual forces are real, and if souls exist, then, you know, then I have a soul, and what am I doing?
Right.
And so there, now, I mean, I'm not saying this is going to replace the Roman road for, like, evangelism techniques, but it is one of those things that I think people who are you know, interested in culture, interested in movies, you know, it's a good avenue for discussion.
Well, you know, we've been talking a lot about specific horror movies that portray spiritual things or evil things or supernatural things. Are there movies... you could probably answer this. Are there movies that are a little too far? Maybe they don't have a proper use for the Christian out there that wants to, you know, there's other movies out there, such as Saw, for example, where it's, you're an hour or two of someone being tortured or people being tortured, and it's almost like a, you know, just kind of odd thing. Just it's not a spiritual movie in any case. But are there movies that are too far that maybe, you know, we talked at the beginning, we don't want to say that this is the command that you should follow, you know, but is there a line, I guess, is what I'm getting at for horror films?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's a perennial question when you talk about this, you know, and a lot of times people just kind of go, well, there's a line and I know where it is, you know, and that line is right here. It's my level of comfort. And so, you know, I do think that there's a place for a certain amount of freedom, you know, discernments for, you know, folks to make these kind of choices. So, for instance, I mean, I've seen Saw. I don't think that Saw is actually a necessarily reprehensible film. It's actually kind of a fairly charmingly made horror movie in a certain way. I haven't watched any of the other ones. I'm not super eager. I'm like, okay, I get the idea. Like, I like, you know, I thought it was a well-executed thing. I don't need to continually kind of return to it. And so there is I think there is a little bit of a trap sometimes in with people who are interested in horror movies that they then kind of like keep, you know, this becomes the main thing they watch. And to some degree, in order to be kind of innovative and interesting, a lot of that depends on, you know, being kind of like more and more shocking and kind of disgusting and, you know, horrible. And so there's a way you can obviously kind of like, if you, with a kind of unbalanced taste, as it were, kind of fall down the rabbit hole of, you know, one particular line of genre and then kind of, you know, keep pursuing more and more extreme versions of that. And so some of what's needed, of course, is the proper development of what I call just like taste. And by taste, I mean, you know, kind of a aesthetic appreciation that's also combined with, you know, a holistic understanding of what's good for people, right? So, you know, our tastes are not just dictated by what we think is the absolute best art, but also by the art in purely aesthetic terms, but also art that actually sort of connects with, as it were, you know, deep values. And so, you know, Christians will necessarily have, as it were, kind of a distinctive taste from unbelievers, because we have, you know, certain values, certain things are very important, you know, important to us. And as it were, we may be more aware, as it were, of the kind of beauty of certain sorts of stories. And so I do want for Christians to have, as a sense, distinctive taste. And I do think that part of a distinctively Christian taste is that we gravitate toward the beautiful and the good and the true, and we want to understand these things. And so, if I met a person who only watched horror movies, every single kind of horror movie, I would have defective taste in some way. And I think the best way to combat bad taste or deficient taste is not the sheer kind of moralism, gone too far. Here's the line, you've crossed it, but rather with sort of supplementing, as it were, that taste with good things. Like if you can't watch a beautiful movie, a movie that has no violence in it, a movie that's about compassion, if you can't watch a story like that with enjoyment, then there's really something wrong with you, you know? And so horror movies, I think, can be part of a Christian's well-balanced diet, but they probably gravitate a little more toward the top of the food pyramid, right? These aren't the vegetables or the meats. These are more like the sweets. And so you don't want to spend your whole diet focusing on such things. And then I think if you keep a well-balanced diet, as it were, you know, kind of properly balanced taste, then you'll just naturally kind of avoid things that you just know, hey, there's really no kind of redeeming value in this. So this is a discussion that I actually am currently having with my co-writer, because we're sort of asking the question like, well, what do we need to watch, right? Do we need to watch everything? Because there's some movies I've avoided, right? You know, some movies I don't really particularly care to see. And so we were talking about a film called Hostel. I'm sure you're familiar with. Maybe some of the viewers are familiar with. Hey, do we need to watch Hostel? It seems like it's kind of relevant to this chapter. I had never seen it, which, you know, I'm sure, you know, horror fans, does this guy know that? He hasn't seen Hostel. And so my co-writer went back and he rewatched it, and he's like, this movie is actually not that valuable. Like, it's not that good, and doesn't really have anything kind of important. So, you know, it's just kind of all this awfulness, and so you can skip it. So we you know, we're still trying to protect our sensibilities, you know, as it were, and like, and keep, you know, keep a properly balanced artistic diet. And I do think that that then kind of helps to, you know, let us kind of discern, as it were, what's really worthwhile and what's not. And so I'm wary of folks who watch nothing but horror movies, as much as I'm wary of people who play nothing but Candy Crush or, you know, watch nothing but, you know, news channels. Like, I think you're not really kind of directing your loves properly if you're stuck only in one groove or one type of entertainment.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. My wife and I, we watch, she's kids movie fan. So about as far as she gets is Secret Life of Pets and, you know, things of that nature. So, when I was preparing for our talk, I wanted to watch, the film that you and Cameron wrote a lot about in the article, The Witch. And, first off, just watching the film, it was a powerful film as far as the quality, the acting, the directing, all those things. I mean, everything you could want in a film. But it was a scary film. Like, it was I don't watch a ton of horror movies, so watching that one was it's a pretty scary film. I thought, well, this is not going to be scary because it's in a totally different time period, and you know, it really didn't pertain to me so much. And you know, laying awake that night, I thought, man, this is creepy. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about The Witch, because I think it's a unique film. I think I really like the film. I think it's a good film. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what makes that film unique, maybe for a Christian, or regarding eternal consequences. There's a few of the things that make that particular film unique.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it came out the gate with a lot of critical attention because it was so different from so many other movies. And so the one thing that everybody talked about is that the writer, director Robert Eggers, was basically went back to a lot of the Puritan writings, I think Cotton Mather especially, and tried to, as it were, kind of pull the language from that time period out and put it into his period piece horror movie, which is set in this kind of Puritan era. At the very beginning of the film, you see the family leaving what I know to be Plymouth Plantation, which is a basically recreation of the Plymouth Colony, heading out into the woods. And as I recall, there's an interview with Robert Eggers and Ari Aster on A24 podcast, and I think he might have said that he actually worked there, or at least he visited there, the Plymouth Plantation. So he had this kind of he's trying to conjure a world, and not just to sort of show, okay, look at these Puritan people struggling with these horrific problems, but to actually make us feel like we're in that time period, you know. So that their language deflected with these, you know, archaisms. They seem to be incredibly serious about the possibility of damnation, the devil. They're concerned about this in a way that we are not. And that is highly unusual for, you know, Hollywood filmmaking. I mean, the devil is often shows up as scary, kills people, does bad stuff in movies. But it's rare that you find sort of, as it were, the devil doing it to people who start out the movie completely terrified of this possibility, right? They're normally just doing other stuff, and then, you know, suddenly this thing catches them blindsided. Long story is, modern people, they're like us. They're not worried about the devil. These people are. And so we already start off with this healthy fear, and then we just move further and further kind of into the, you know, into danger and darkness. And Eggers himself, he's got a new movie that's coming out called The Lighthouse. Seems like his project is, to some degree, this kind of historical time machine approach, where he's going to, you know, almost teleport us to a different era and give us a sense of what a story would look like in that time. He said he's trying to evoke what you might call like a Puritan's nightmare, you know. Cameron actually did most of the writing on the chapter. He deserves most of the credit for this connection. He compares Eggers' movie to, you know, Jonathan Edwards' famous Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, right? You know, Edwards, you know, by all accounts, not the most exciting orator, but the words of his sermon cause people to panic and faint and repent. You know, his words deeply connect with people. This possibility of, of hell, you're just kind of dangling right over hell. It's nothing but kind of God's arbitrary grace that holds you from this. And so, Eggers brings that back to us. He brings it close again, but we're watching the movie, which I think is a really interesting effect. And so, actually maybe that's one of the movies I'd say more people should watch. Going back to the first question, I wouldn't mind more people watching that movie, because I think that it is a really powerful evocation of an important Christian theme. Jesus himself, probably talks more about damnation than just about anybody else. The movie makes the weight of that available to us again. Gives us a sense of the possibility of damnation, and that perhaps the lurking dangers of temptations that can lead us there.
Yeah, the movie is rich with themes and even just these connections. You pointed out one of the connections in your article that you wrote with Cameron. Either you or Cameron pointed this out, but I thought it was really neat how they use certain, I guess, inspiration for the imagery or the visuals in the film. So Francisco Goya's black paintings, you see a lot of that imagery in there. And I had no idea. I'm not the most, when it comes to art, I'm just new to some of these, artists. And so when I started reading Francisco Goya and kind of digging in, it was just really just a bizarre story that he had painted some of these murals on his walls in his home, the black paintings that we have. And then when you see the pictures, I mean, they're terrifying. If you see the paintings, they're very, they're very creepy. So it was just neat to see the visuals, even in the film, had relevance. They had meaning, thought that was cool.
Yeah. Goya, really stands out. There aren't a lot of artists who are notable for their evocation of the horrific. Typically we look to classic painters for their ability to capture beauty and present it to us. And Goya is one of those unique figures. The movie also just, conjures to some degree just a lot of the difficulties of pre-modern life, or pre-industrial age life, child death, and to some degree the kind of just the difficulties of life in a really tender way. But it also gets at the temptations of the devil in unexpected ways. You've got Black right. Philip the Goat. Dost thou want to live deliciously? Is sort of the question. And having lived for an hour and 15 minutes or whatever in Eggers' world, you can sort of feel the temptation of that a bit more. These are people that are really, dealing with genuine hardship. And so nowadays we're pretty comfortable. We might think, why would anybody want to sell their soul to the devil for a little bit of power and pleasure? We have all the power and pleasure we want. It's often pointed out that, the devil will leave you alone as long as the world and the flesh, are doing their work. It's only when you start resisting them that the devil has to take a hand and interfere. And so you see the devil reaching out, trying to grab these souls.
Right. Yeah. There's a couple of scenes in the film that are iconic. One is the scene where Caleb, the younger boy, is talking with his father about original sin, and he's asking his father some tough questions. As any boy does at a certain age, you start asking questions about the things you believe. And I thought that was just a really powerful scene. I don't know if you had anything you wanted to say on that scene in particular, if there's anything we can learn from that scene, but I thought that was one of the most iconic scenes in the film.
Yeah. Well, as one would expect, these Puritan folk do take, sin seriously, really, genuinely see all people as being affected by the fall, which is a helpful reminder. I mean, there is a sense in which, that we are encountering still like an alien world. And so it can be somewhat easy to look at the movie and say, well, that's, you know, that's them then, you know, dealing with that. Part of what makes The Exorcist interesting, you know, is that it's a much more modern movie, which you have a priest, you know, who's struggling with that, right? See, everybody's struggling with doubt. And so the kind of doubt itself, which is something that's not, in a sense, available to the characters in The Witch, you know, is at the very forefront of a movie like The Exorcist, you know, which is like people are still struggling with their faith. And as, you know, as modern people, that tends to be our situation a bit more. You know, we kind of, you know, we're less likely to go along with these sort of traditional teachings and think, you know, no, maybe those things aren't true. But what's interesting about horror movies very often is that they are, in a sense, kind of conservative, which they're sort of, as it were, you know, bringing back the old things and challenging us with the notion, you know, for instance, you know, you think you're so morally good and you've got everything figured out. Actually, you don't. Like, look at how easily your world can be exploded. Look at how bad you really are on the inside. And so there is a kind of a hellfire preacher quality to almost all horror movies, at least ones that are any good.
Right. Yeah. Well, one of the things that, and another scene in the film that I just thought was powerful, the film doesn't really offer a lot of hope for this particular family. There's, you know, a lot going on that they just have no control over. And they're praying, you know, God save me. And, you know, I'm paraphrasing, obviously, but they're praying these deep prayers of repentance. They start to wonder, is there something wrong with me? You know, so there's this scene where the mother is there and the boy is in this sort of trance. And she looks up at her husband and she says, I just want to go home. And of course, they've been separated from their home. And you wrote a little bit about the scene, and you and Cameron, and in the article, you both wrote that this is a deeply humane moment in a film that often feels strange and remote. Never do we forget that these are real flesh and blood people struggling to make the best of their circumstances. Though it abounds in startling imagery and occult rituals, The Witch offers none of the convenient escapism most of us expect from our entertainment. It's a film that inspires fear, revulsion, and yes, horror. So I think that is often representative of reality for some people who it seems like pray, God, deliver me from this, and it doesn't happen. So maybe you could expound on that a little bit. How does this scene or, you know, this film reflect a realistic experience when it comes to tragedy and suffering?
Obviously the best person who ever lived, Jesus Christ himself, prayed to be delivered from the thing he was about to face, and the answer was no. Hmm. Right. So if anyone's a follower of Jesus, they shouldn't expect that they will not suffer, but you know, at best that their sufferings might be made like Christ's, you know, meaningful and ultimately redeemable. That's our great hope. The movie's grounded in a reality that, you know, most people throughout history and most people throughout the world do experience, which is, you know, very real, you know, danger, very real discomfort, you know, very real difficulty. Though, of course, the irony is that it's actually people in those situations who are often kind of better able, as it were, to kind of find hope and comfort in the gospel than people like us who live in very comfortable situations. So undoubtedly part of the allure of horror movies has to do with the fact that we are actually detached in some ways from the real situation in which most people throughout the history of the world lived. Right? Infant mortality rate, you know, throughout most of the world, you know, I don't know, somewhere around 50%, maybe a little better than that, you know, depending on circumstance. You know, I'm a father of four kids. I never lost a kid. To me, it seems utterly devastating and life-destroying. Most people have actually, whoever lived, have, you know, experienced this. At least, you know, a good proportion of people have experienced this. And so there is a sense in which kind of horror movies, as it were, actually bring us a lot closer to the material reality of most of our human brothers and sisters who've lived throughout time. And so I think that partly we're hungry to, you know what, you know, those sorts of experiences are like. because, you know, the problems that we deal with are, you know, somebody not liking our post on Facebook and wondering why they didn't, or, you know, not getting the kind of the job that we wanted while we're still materially very comfortable, or just, you know, kind of having anxiety about our, you know, our appearance. I'm not trying to belittle the problems that, you know, modern people face, but there is a sense in which we're, you know, we live in the most materially comfortable time ever, but yet people are also incredibly anxious, depressed, dealing with a lot of psychological difficulty. And so, you know, I think there is a kind of, as it were, a missing piece for a lot of, you know, modern Western people, which is a deeper understanding of what, you know, what suffering is actually like, you know, what sort of the real difficulties people face, what true horrors can look like. And so we partly turn to, I think, these movies to attempt to understand. Now, that's not to say that's the best. People still do, of course, face, you know, different sorts of horrors. You know, there's all sorts of social, emotional, physical abuse that still happens in, you know, very posh McMansions, you know, neighborhoods all around us. And not to dismiss those things, but it is, I think it is the case that there is a kind of renewed fascination, as it were, partly because, you know, horrors, as it were, kind of shock us back, as it were, into an understanding of what a lot of life really is like.
Yeah, it seems like horror movies, like we said earlier, it's that friend that you just, you don't want him to say anything, but he's probably good to keep around because he's honest and straightforward. Before I get you out of here, just a couple other things. Number one, are there, we've mentioned a few, but any quality horror films that you would recommend anyone? And then secondly, is there a place that anyone who's, let's say someone's listening to this and they've just enjoyed this talk and they want to go a little deeper, can find you and Cameron and any future work you may be doing on horror out there? So just those two questions.
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, horror movie recommendations. Well, you know, it all depends on what your taste is or what, you know, where you are. You know, I think that a lot of times the best thing to do is to just do a little bit of traveling back into the past if you're sort of uncertain about, you know, content. One nice thing about classic movies is that they, you know, have a little stricter guidelines and, you know, maybe you're going to be a little less scary out the gate. So I do love Alfred Hitchcock. I think Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho is a landmark movie. And it's brilliantly made. It's, you know, interesting in its structure. Hitchcock, you can sort of feel Hitchcock's cinematic mind at work throughout the thing. And, you know, and I think it's a interesting movie to watch and to think about, which is why Hitchcock is always so wonderful. So you can't really go wrong there. If you like Hitchcock, you can go on and watch The Birds, which almost feels like a kind of a meta meditation on horror movies because birds aren't scary, but the birds in this movie are attacking everybody. And so he's sort of playing, as it were, almost with the kind of conventions of this sort of nature gone wild, you know, horror movie genre. And so, you know, those are quite good. I mean, of course there are some longstanding classics of, you know, for filmmaking. So The Shining is, you know, arguably one of the best horror movies ever made. It's an interesting film. Stephen King is a writer that I respect a lot. He writes powerfully and but also very thoughtfully. There's a lot of humanity in his writing, and so you know, that movie made by Kubrick, one of our great filmmakers, and that book by Stephen King, one of our great popular novelists, are a lot of, you know, they're interesting to read and to consider. So if people have already watched through all of those, then you can actually read Cameron McAllister. He does a lot of writing on Christ and pop culture, and he writes about horror movies, especially some contemporary horror movies. So you can go read his work there, and he'll be kind of commending different things to you. And so folks might want to check that out. I've got a book called The Poetics of Evil. Last chapter deals with horror, but it's expensive. It's an academic book. That's very, you know, small print, large words. And if somebody wants to go really deep, they can, you know, read through the whole book to get to the last chapter on horror.
Right, right. Oh man, I've enjoyed talking to you, man. This has been fun. You had something else to add?
Yeah. And of course, in a few years, Cameron and I will have a book out from Lexham Press called Cinema Inferno, How Horror Movies Can Save Your Soul. And so we're working on that right now.
Man, can't wait to read that. That sounds so interesting. Just looking forward to it, man. This whole talk has been fun. This has probably been one of the most unique podcasts that we've done. Because I know that there are people out there that enjoy horror films, and they may not be enjoying them because they're dark or something's wrong with them or they're weird. They just enjoy film as a whole. A lot of times, it's people who enjoy film, and there's a culture out there that enjoys particularly the genre of horror. And I think it's important for Christians to talk about, because many of us have either seen horror films or we actually really like horror films, and maybe we don't tell everybody, but it's really a unique style of film, and it's these are some good reasons why I think you can enjoy that without feeling like that, feeling ashamed of that. I guess this is a good reason to enjoy horror films, and I think they do have positive qualities to offer. And if you don't enjoy them, like you said in the beginning, you don't enjoy them, that's okay. But if you do, these are some good reasons to enjoy the genre itself. So,
yeah. And you always want to keep balancing that with, beautiful, thoughtful, articulate art. These are the, you make sure you eat your veggies as well. And, as well as, sipping the interesting poison of horror movies. I do think that, like, for people who really want to dig deeper and understand culture, at least being aware of what's going on in horror is valuable. Not everybody is called to that. I don't think my grandma, my faithful, old kind of grandma, needs to know what's going on in horror. But for someone who think, who's really trying to kind of consider culture, understand it, and interact with it, there's a lot of value to thinking through these issues, and a lot of outreach potential.
Absolutely. Well, we saw the outreach potential and just the example you gave. That's a great example. So absolutely, absolutely. Well, thank you for doing this with us, man. I really appreciate it. Just been a pleasure having you on.
Glad to do it. Thanks, Mark.
No problem. Hey, man, we're done recording. But yeah, thanks, man.